Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batabile Ntombeni. I'm a mediator and negotiator, and I am happy to welcome to the show Deborah Hamilton. She is an attorney and mediator, and we're going to talk today about an area of mediation that makes total sense once you think about it, but it seems that most people don't think about it, and that is pet mediation. So, Deborah, I'm going to turn on your mic, and you are on the show. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Bathabille. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. I was, of course, really intrigued when I heard that you practice pet mediation, and I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about that. But as we usually do on the show, because this is a show about stories, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your story. So let's go back a little bit and talk a bit about what in your childhood ultimately has led you into the path that you now travel.
Well, early in my childhood, I had pets. I had a German Schnauzer and an Irish Setter, and I loved those pets. I also did horseback riding, so I loved my horses. I never owned one until I was older, but I loved them. And when I went to law school, I always was drawn to animal law, but because I went to law school in the early 80s, there was really no animal law as there is today. So it was contract law, it was civil practice, it was criminal law, but it was never something called animal law. And now there is, to a great degree. So my practice started in the Westchester Assistant District Attorney's office. I was an assistant district attorney. Then I went to the MTA Inspector General, and each job I got worked around my love of animals, because once I got married and graduated from law school, I got my own dog and started showing them in obedience and then in the breed ring. So I was surrounded by dogs and people who love dogs my whole life. And as everyone knows, when there's dogs and people, there can sometimes be conflict, and I would watch people get into conflict and sue each other. And sometimes after I went into private practice, I would be the attorney on either side, and no one ever won. Even though we won, no one ever won. So when I returned to the practice of law after a 13-year hiatus to raise my sons, I realized I wasn't really drawn to litigation the way I used to be, and I decided to pursue mediation on a grand scale for everything. And then I realized I really had a niche that no one else had because of my experience with dog show people and rescue, and that I would enable them to have this stopgap before litigation, to enable them to have that conversation that once you start litigation, attorneys sometimes don't enable the parties to have with each other. So I create that space.
Oh, that is really awesome. I'm curious about the dog show world. I don't know that a lot of people who are listening are really familiar with that, and I think it requires a little bit of understanding about what that's all about and perhaps the passions that are involved in that to understand why your practice has become so necessary, or has been necessary all along, I suppose, but it just wasn't there. So talk to me about showing dogs and how you got involved in that.
Well, I got involved in showing dogs because a friend of my husband and mine had gone to obedience class, and his dog was so well trained, it was a Springer Spaniel, that I swore that when I got a dog, I was going to obedience class. And so I got a dog, trained it in obedience, and then I went to a dog show to compete and get her CD and her CDX, and I would watch these beautiful Irish setters run around the ring in confirmation, and I went, God, those are beautiful. So I started in that. And
Hold on, Deborah, for a moment, because you've talked about a bunch of stuff that I don't know what that means. When you say that she got her CD and her CDX, what is that?
The AKC created a venue in which people who wanted to train their dogs to be good citizens could get a certificate that says good citizen. Then from there, you can progress and get what's called a companion dog, which means the dog comes when it's called, it heels by your side, it sits and stays when you tell it to. And then there are various levels. So there are ones that do the basic sit, stay, come, and then there's ones that do jumps and find articles. And so it's at various levels. It's like beginner, advanced and expert in dogdom where you would be able to do things. And now they have two different areas, or three different areas, I think. They have rally, agility, and obedience. So in rally, they do all sorts of jumping and going through hoops, and it's amazing.
Oh,
and same with agility.
Yeah.
So
right,
the AKC has created this venue of competition for people, and it's good-hearted competition. It's not, competition. Everybody roots for everyone. Everybody's pleased with everybody's dog's participation and completion. Everybody gets disappointed when a dog doesn't do what it's supposed to do, but no one ever gets angry at the dog. They just go, they'll do it every time correctly in practice, and then when they get in the ring, they look at you and go, ha-ha, I don't have to do it this time, and so they don't. So we all stand around, and we've all been there. It's sort of like having your slip fall when you're in confirmation. Everybody's been there, so you just laugh. But it's doing something with your dog above and beyond just having them sit on the couch that, brings people who are in love with animals together. And when you bring people who are in love with animals together, sometimes there's conflict as well.
Right. I'm curious about something else then. I've noticed in the competitions that I've seen, it seems that there may be a predominance of one breed or another. Is it? Are there certain breeds that are more suitable or amenable to doing
absolutely,
kind of
because in rally and in agility and in obedience, there are dogs that are bred to be watchers, like the herding dogs are phenomenal obedience dogs because they're taught to watch. I mean, inherently, they're taught to watch. The shepherd tells them what to do, and the sheep doing what they do, they watch and they see, so they're phenomenal obedience dogs. And then sporting dogs and love to do the rally and the agility because it's all about moving, and they love to move. So there are less, say, small dogs like Yorkshires. But you know what? Any dog can be in obedience. Any dog can be in agility. And, it's being with your dog and enjoying them. And they get so much fun out of being with you that any dog can be taught to do this.
And how long does it take to train a dog to get to that level of, expert, let's say?
Well, if you want to get to an expert, it probably takes about a year or two or three, depending on the breed of the dog, the ability of the dog to catch on, your experience as a handler, because sometimes the dogs are so much smarter than you are and catch on so much faster, and you don't catch on. We have, in the breed handling ring, we have owners who still don't show their dogs to the best ability, and the dogs are so much better than they are, and we usually say to them, just let the dog show itself. It does such a better job than, because, you get nervous, you forget what you're supposed to be doing, and the dog never forgets because, they know what they're doing. They're very smart.
My goodness. Are there any dogs in particular that you've seen that have been outstanding to you?
Well, in for me, for my dogs, of course, Irish Setters are outstanding to me in every single one of the venues because they are completely dedicated to understanding what it is you want them to do and doing it. They don't do it for you. I always say they're my Jerry Maguire dog. Show me the money. What's in it for me? And the Irish Setter will do it for you, as opposed to a Golden Retriever or a Lab that sometimes will do things just because you ask them. Irish Setters got a bad rap in the 70s because they were very overbred after the movie, which happens to every dog when a movie comes out. Dalmatians, Old English Sheepdogs, German Shepherds. When a movie comes out depicting that dog, people get it, not understanding the true personality of the dog and whether it fits with the owner. Good breeders will require that the owner have an understanding of the personality of the dog they're adopting, because that way they know the dog will have a forever home and the owners will know what they're getting into. I mean, it behooves the breeder to be completely honest about what the dog needs in its first year, and it behooves the owner to understand about that dog and do what the breeder says so that they have a great companion for the next 10 to 16 years.
And I know that this is something that a lot of people really don't think about. They think, oh, the dog looks so cute. I remember when Chihuahuas were in vogue and a lot of people were getting them and discovering that from a personality standpoint, perhaps they'd made a mistake.
Absolutely. You really have to do more. People do more research buying a refrigerator than they do buying a dog. And in shelters, you can pick a dog that is one of the designer breeds, because it's a mixed breed, and at least in a shelter, they've evaluated it as much as they can, where when you buy a designer breed, you may not get a true read because you don't know how much of the golden retriever and how much of the poodle you're going to get, or how much of the Yorkshire and the Bichon you're going to get, so you don't know which part of its parent is going to be dominant. Or if you buy a dog from a reputable breeder who's breeding purebreds, and they're honest and they're reputable and they come highly recommended, you create the ability to have somebody tell you honestly what's good about their dogs and what you have to watch for and what you should do. I mean, my owners go home with a 10-page packet, not of a contract. My contract's one page long. But my suggestions for them start with make sure that you create a space for them to behave while you still outweigh them. You know, once a dog gets to be a year old, it's much harder to control them than when you get them at 8 or 12 or 15 weeks. And when they're cute and they're doing something really cute, just in your mind's eye, think if that's going to be really cute when they weigh 60 pounds.
Exactly.
And if it isn't, then nip it in the bud when they're babies so that they don't do it when they're older, because they don't realize they grow. They think they're still puppies, even the Great Dane thinks he still can climb in your lap
yes.
when he's fully grown. They don't get that they get bigger.
I've seen that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, there's this awesome photograph that I've seen on Facebook that's going around of a man reclining in a big, comfy, like, lazy boy kind of chair. And his, I think it's a Great Dane, is just draped all over him.
Absolutely. I mean, dogs and their masters, it's funny, I have many, many Irish setters because I show them and they're my companions and they go to work with me. People say to me, you must have a lot of property. They must run all the time. And I said, well, they do like to go outside and run, but they have an in and out door. And on any given moment, they will be in my office, in puppy cups, on the couches, because that's where they want to be. Every dog really wants to be with their companion. They don't want to be alone outside running around. And it's interesting. People say to me, why do you sell Irish setters? They're such big dogs to people who live in the city. And I said, because the people who live in the city are making a commitment to my dog because they have to get it out 2-3 times a day. People who live in the suburbs will throw the dog out in the backyard, it's fenced, and leave it there. And that dog is the one that's going to dig, that's going to chew the house, that's going to get out and run around and possibly get hit by a car because it wants to be with its people. It doesn't really want to be by itself.
And I think that's also something it's important to get out. There's so much that I'm learning in what you're saying, and I'm hoping that folks are listening are learning about that too, you know, in terms of their interest with animals. We will be getting into the mediation part of things. But just prevention, of course, you know, the old adage, it's worth an ounce of, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Pound of cure,
and,
right.
And what you're talking about right now, I think, may go a long way into preventing the kinds of situations we'll be talking about regarding mediation. You know, the choices that people make, and then also understanding what their dogs need, what their pets
absolutely.
Need.
Absolutely.
From them.
Because it's usually my clients who live in apartment buildings who either don't create the time to spend with their dogs, so they're bored, so they bark incessantly, or they get a dog from a shelter and don't know how to break them of their separation anxiety, which takes a great deal of time. There are people who pay their rent by walking people's dogs in the city, and you have to really find that right person for your dog who's going to create that companionship that you might not be able to give because you're working. And if you're out in the suburbs, you really have to make time to be with your dog, but you have to recognize that this is your dog. It's not your neighbor's dog, and it's not the kids at the soccer field's dog, and you have to respect the fact that your neighbor may not have a dog because they don't want a dog, and even though it's the suburbs and all dogs should run free, not really. And if you're at the soccer game, you know, my dog is really good with kids, it loves kids. Well, there may be a child there who didn't have a good experience with a dog, and so that child's going to be distracted and not really play his best game because he's afraid. So you have to really understand the conflict that people have that may apply to your dog, not because of your dog, but because of another dog, and really respect other people.
Well, I want to start then getting into the conflict situations that you deal with by perhaps starting with the relationship between the owner and the dog. You mentioned dogs barking when you're away, and you had mentioned boredom, and I'm curious, is that why they do it? They're bored? They're lonely?
Absolutely. Dogs bark because they're scared, they're bored, they're lonely, and they want to attract attention. They want to, I mean, that's what they're bred to do. They're attracting attention to warn you. Well, they'll attract attention because they're so sad or upset. And usually you can, if you watch Cesar Millan or Dogs in the City, the new program on television about the dog walker in the city, it's about creating a schedule, a continuity of connection with that animal that creates the space where they will then feel very loved and secure. I have 9 Irish setters, and I have neighbors,
wow.
And my dogs bark. They do. And I absolutely create a space where I go and talk to them and say, okay, how's it working? Is it working for you? Is it getting worse sometimes than others? Let me know. And it usually is when I'm at work, and I'm not able to take the dogs with me, then they go outside in their bed. And if the landscapers are here, they're even worse. So I recognize that they have to be in. They have to be in the house and quiet, because that way I don't disturb my neighbors. I respect the fact that it's my choice to have my dogs. It's not my neighbor's choice to have my dogs. And so I try to respect their desire for silence. A lot of people don't do that. They say, listen, dogs bark. Get over it. They can bark from 6 a.m. Usually town ordinances say they can bark from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. And
wow.
After 5 minutes, it's crazy. So you really need to be aware of that. And the people who get crazy on dog barking know what the ordinance is. And 9 times out of 10, instead of saying something to their neighbor, because people get very confrontational. I've had several mediations between neighbors who got confrontational because the dogs barked, or the dogs were in the front fenced-in area and scared people walking by. I've had several mediations where I said, do you realize that, well, my dogs have to go out. Do you realize that the neighbors are frightened by this? Well, my dogs have to go out. Well, we have to work on how your dogs behave when they're out there. And it's not a criticism of you or the way you trained your dogs. It's just that everybody has this ability to walk on the street, and your dogs have the ability to be in their pen. So how can we do this in a way that makes everybody happy? And it's how you approach somebody with what can we do, as opposed to, you know, your dogs are scaring me, take them in the house. It, you know, that's very confrontational. If you can create...
I was going to say, let's drill down into that. Let's talk about that, because it seems like it can be a rather intractable situation. So I'm really curious about the kinds of solutions that could come out, because, you know, the dogs are going to do what dogs do. The dogs have needs as well, as you've mentioned. And then the neighbors have needs as well, and the owners need to be away at work. So how do you drill down into that kind of situation and come up with something that's workable for everyone?
Well, I create a space where everybody gets heard and understood and respected. So the neighbor gets to talk about how their entire life is ruined by these dogs who bark, how they can't walk by this house. They get to really vent. And then the dog owner gets to vent on how my dogs have to be out and they have to get fresh air and you'll just have to live with it. And so everyone is, as you well know, Beth Abiel, when you're in a mediation, you reflect and you respond to the feelings and emotions that can't be responded to in court but can be responded to in mediation. So you respect and understand each person's feelings. And as you're doing it, because you're the neutral, you enable the other person to hear it in a different way and hear how one-sided sometimes their feelings are, and they either correct me, no, that's not what I meant to say. Okay, good, then tell me what you meant to say. And then the other person will hear that they're not as selfish as they perceive they were. And so people get to the point where, wow, you really do understand that this bothers me, and wow, you really do understand that my dogs need to get out. And so from there, after you've allowed them to vent, so to speak, in a safe environment that's neutral and confidential, you allow them to vent, and then you move forward to that point where, okay, so we live next door to each other. How do we work this out? I mean, no one is ever going to say, just keep your dogs inside forever. And no one's ever going to say, my dogs are going to be out forever and just deal with it. They, you know, you live with people, and once you feel that person is hearing how important your dogs are to you and how important the peace is to you, they get to a point where they can talk about times. So if I like to sleep till 10 o'clock on a Saturday, maybe I put my dogs in the car and take them to the park first thing in the morning on Saturday, twice a month. So that, you know, the things that my clients come up with as solutions just bend my mind. I mean, I had clients who changed apartments because the dog was walking on the wood floors, and they just absolutely changed apartments, and it solved it. I would never have thought of that as an attorney. I would have never have thought of that, quite frankly, as a mediator. They thought of it.
Huh. So they were actually able to move in the same building.
Yeah. They just switched apartments. It was a small building, and they just switched apartments.
Wait, they switched apartments with each other?
Yeah. So that the
dogs
walking wouldn't bother them anymore.
Wow.
Now, would you have thought of that, Dr. Beal? I would never have thought of that. I would never
have
suggested that as an attorney or as a mediator. And one of them, you know, we were doing the Himmelstein board, right? And they were thinking about it, and they threw it out. We could always switch apartments. And they go, really? Okay, let's see about that. And that's what they did. It took a little jockeying. It took a little changes, but they did. That's what they did.
But do me a favor, for folks who are listening who are not really familiar with mediation or Jack Himmelstein, what is the Himmelstein board?
Well, the Himmelstein approach is understanding-based mediation. So you sit there and you put up on one of the post-it note boards what people's needs and wants are, what their desires are, so they can see it. What is it that you really want? What is it at the end of the day that you really want? So they're up there and you're looking at them. And then you create a space for what is the interests you're trying to preserve. So it's different. So the interests you're trying to preserve are different, and you create a space where people see what each of them want, and then they grade them, A, B, C, D, and you recognize that a lot of the things that they want are similar. And so they then see tangibly the similarities in the end of the day, what they want, and they can work toward a solution.
That's amazing.
I think every mediator... Go ahead.
I was going to say, of course, this is something I'm familiar with in my own practice. It's great
right.
to hear you talking about it and allow folks to understand how it could be visualized. You know, I do an exercise myself when I'm training in negotiation, actually, that is similar, where I'll have two groups of people go through a problem. They each want different things, and I'll have them go through an exercise that actually comes out of getting past no, you know, the
right.
book Getting Past No. And it's amazing when they put their proposals together to see how often the proposals really just overlap.
Absolutely, and that's what this does. This creates that
right.
space to overlap so you can see the commonality.
Exactly, whereas when I asked them what did they expect, what did they anticipate from the other person, they were anticipating total intractability, that you know they had nothing in common, and that it would never work out.
Well, that's what you had said at the beginning of how do you get people with pets to talk to each other because they're at such odds. And really, the dog owner and the non-dog owner are not at such odds because they do want similar things. It's just one includes an animal and one doesn't. And when they see that and they see the respect that one gives to another, because most people really do want to end up with a retained relationship. And that's when I do my speeches to breeders and owners and handlers and rescues, I go, the end of the day is somebody wants to be understood, somebody wants to be respected, and they want to retain a relationship because, quite frankly, the rescues want to retain the relationship with their rescuers because they really don't want to lose a home. And the tenants and landlords want to retain relationships because you have to see them in the elevator. And in divorce, you want to retain a relationship. I just actually wrote a blog about, you know, Kristen and Peterson, whatever his name is, Robert Peterson, Kristen Stewart and Robert Peterson, because they're fighting over a dog. I said this is the last best thing that they had in their relationship. And it is sort of like ripping a child out of your hands now. In the old days, when I was young, people never articulated how much their pet meant to them. Now, in the 90s and the 2000s, people are really articulating and spending money, $53 million or billion dollars, I think, last year, on their pets across the board, that in fact pets are so much more valuable to people now that they will go to the mat for them. And to think that you can separate from a divorce or you can separate from a relationship where you've had time with a pet that meant something to you without ever seeing them again is really difficult to swallow. And some people use them, especially in divorce, they use them as pawns. So if you want this dog, then you leave $20,000 on the table. There was an article in the Miami Herald where an attorney said, I can't believe my client left $20,000 on the table to keep a dog, and it was an old dog. And I wrote a comment saying, and this is why people lose money in order to keep a dog, because the mediation, the discussion that attorneys don't necessarily enable their clients to have to get to the root of why they want to charge their spouse all that heartbreak, they want to charge their spouse for the dog, has nothing to do with the value of the dog, but rather has to do with proving a point. And if you could have that conversation, Bathabil, which you know that's why we're in mediation, to have that conversation that attorneys don't necessarily let us have, then you sometimes can walk away without having to pay $20,000 to keep the dog.
Right, right. I mean, it's almost like what happens with children, actually, then, right? People using the pets as pawns.
Yep, and, of course, in childless families, the divorce.
The dog is the child.
Dog is the child. Yep, the dog is the child.
My goodness. Do you work mainly with people who own dogs or other
pets involved?
I
work mainly with people who own pets. So I've done parrots, I've done horses, I do conflicts in the Bedford riding lanes where the landowners have a right-of-way over their property for horses to go by. Some horse owners are very respectful, some aren't. Some landowners are very respectful, some aren't. So there's, you know, conflicts there. I work with people who own dogs, breed dogs, handle dogs, that their conflicts can be resolved in a space where they can retain their relationship. There was just an article in a dog journal called Dogs in Review that spoke to having co-ownerships that work and how communication was key to those co-ownerships working. And what happens, you know, I'm an attorney, you're an attorney. What happens when attorneys get involved is that link of conversation is stopped. A friend of mine said something this morning that really resonated with me, and I'm going to write a blog about it. You know, your First Amendment right to speak stops when you hire an attorney because they speak for you. In mediation,
that
you still have
it. Amazing, amazing insight.
It was amazing. She's an accountant, too, very scary. But she said that. I said, I absolutely have to say that. She said, you know, she went through a divorce, and she said the attorney would get up and say things, and she'd be like, no. And she said, okay, so I'm going to be held in contempt if I stand up and say you're wrong. And yet, you know, the attorney doesn't enable you to have that. Very few attorneys. There are wonderful attorneys out there that recognize the value in enabling their clients to have conversations. They're collaborative attorneys usually, but allow their clients to have conversation. And in animal law, there are the cases that need to be brought to the Supreme Court to save the plight of animals. And then there are the cases that clutter the dockets, that create animosity between the courts and people, because just go out and settle this. I wish I had a dollar for every time I had a judge say to me, Mrs. Hamilton, go out there and have your client settle this case. Your Honor, if I could do that, I'd be happy. I can't, which is why I now mediate. I don't want a judge telling me to do something anymore. I really want to help my clients do it for themselves because, Bathabil, you know, quite frankly, the people in the conflict know how to resolve it. They just don't know how to get there themselves.
Right, right. Or they're dealing with the whole emotion aspect of things. I've become really interested in the idea of emotional intelligence and what happens physiologically when a person becomes upset or fearful. And
you
how
and I
it
both.
Can be, yeah, right. You know, and how
Jeremy
be,
Luck, I love doing that neuroscience stuff because it really points to, especially with animals, because, you know, mediation of a business or mediation of a divorce without an animal or mediation of some other conflict. But with an animal, all it is emotion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because, I mean, what else could it be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, really. Wow, that is deep. I'm curious about the kinds of, cases that are involved in animal law. When you say animal law, what does that mean?
So animal law, there are wonderful groups that are out there striving to make chickens' lives better. You know, free-range chickens versus cage chickens, you know, beef cattle that live a better life than they do in the slaughterhouses. I don't do that kind of law, but I'm a member of the Animal Law Committee, and we are constantly researching and trying to write Friends of the Court articles or briefs to support the idea of treating animals with dignity. And a lot of people don't treat animals with dignity. For my purposes, puppy mills are an anisma. However, if you shut them down, they start somewhere else. You have to really have, in my opinion, a mediation where you do incremental steps, because you have to recognize that the people who run puppy mills, this is how they feed their family. They know no better. This is how they feed their family, and to shut them down creates huge angst if you enable them. It's sort of like going into the middle of the Appalachians and teaching people how to farm or teaching people how to do a craft. If you enable people to understand how to keep these pets so that, in fact, they can keep them in cleaner environments and safer and healthier, incrementally, they may do that. It may not happen overnight, as if you get a court order and you shut them down and it stops right away. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I love doing that, but it doesn't, and we all know it doesn't. They just open somewhere else. Right. If you take the time to create space where you help them figure out how to do it in a way that's more respectful to the animal, you know, you're not going to stop people from wanting a golden retriever next Tuesday. And as a breeder, I can tell you, I cannot give you a dog next Tuesday. My girls come into season every 6 months. I then keep the puppies for 12 weeks. Sometimes that coincides with Christmas, sometimes it doesn't. And I can't supply you with a dog on your child's birthday. I can't supply you with a dog on Christmas, but a puppy mill can, and a pet store can, because the puppies are just constant.
Right. Well, the example that you were giving really gets to the heart of what mediation can be all about, because your interest isn't really in shutting down people's ability to make a living in the way that they know how or desire to, but that it's the way that they're doing it that's an issue.
Right, and it's talking to them. It's having that conversation, which is what drew me to mediation in the first place, because clearly I talk a lot, but I really want to have the ability to enable these people to have that conversation, because it's not all about how I feel. It's me enabling them to have the conversation about how they feel and how they can then move forward. And it's, you know, slow and steady Eddie. I've been talking to insurance companies that insure vets who say, we don't talk to any clients unless they sue us. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. They just want to talk to the vet. And they go, nope, they have to sue us first. So now I'm trying to get on the docket to teach vets at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, their vet school, how to speak to people when in conflict. So before they call their insurance carrier and say, listen, this person might sue me, they will be enabled to have a conversation that may take the heat down, and then the person won't sue them, and the person won't leave their practice with five of their best friends. And so economically, this is a smart thing to do.
Of course. And we know this. It's amazing to understand the kinds of savings that people have, both in terms of material, you know, wealth, money, and then in terms of time and stress and understanding.
And relationship.
That for some and relationship, yes, yeah, very important. But, you know, for some reason, we are still so stuck in this litigious posture that you can have a company
nobody knows
not
I'm
realize.
Here. Yeah.
Well, it's beyond that, though, because I'm wondering at the fact that you've had conversations with insurance companies where they could actually save a heck of a lot of money on their bottom line, because they're in the business of saving money. They want to keep the money that is paid in, their premiums. You know, they don't want to have to be paying them out. But if somebody sues them, they have to reply. They're going to be paying lawyers. Why would they want to do that when there's another option?
Because they're in the mindset of 50% to 75% of the people who threaten to sue don't. Because when you and I, as a dog owner on the street, pet owner on the street, parrot owner on the street, realize it's going to cost me $5,000 to get back $5,000, I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, you know, it's I'm not going to do it. So they actually save money because they just wait to see if, in fact, the person sues. And if the person sues, then they go to mediation. But
meanwhile,
if the person doesn't sue, and then
right.
the person's the vet is the biggest
exactly.
loser because,
exactly.
you know, they lose the client and possibly some of their friends, and their reputation gets tarnished, even though they haven't been sued. because the client says, listen, this guy would never speak to me or this woman would never speak to me, and it's ridiculous. All I wanted to say was, or all I wanted to know was X. And if the insurance companies would enable, because as you and I know, Beth Beale, mediation is confidential. So it's not as if you're going to run into court and say, do you know that the vet said this? Well, yeah, the vet is going to talk in a mediation in a way that is hopefully honest and forthright. And so is the owner of the animal. And at the end of the day, hopefully it'll be resolved. If it isn't, whatever the vet says, that the owner can then use against them in court is discoverable. Because if he says, well, I made a mistake, some vet somewhere who's an expert is going to say, well, he made a mistake. It won't be coming out of his mouth. It'll be coming out of an expert's mouth saying, yes, he made a mistake. He didn't do this or he did this. So you're going to be found out. And, you know, it's better, you and I know this, it's better to be honest up front and recognize your limitations and your failures and accept your responsibility than to say, hey, just sue me and see if you can prove it.
Right, right. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, you've talked a bit about relationships between vets and their patients and the owners of their patients. You talked about In the dog show world, and I'd actually like to go back to that a little bit. I'm curious about what kinds of conflicts arise out of those situations. Sure.
Oh, it's my favorite area because I've just been asked to speak at the 2013 National for the Irish Setter Club of America about contracts and conflict, and it is about a passion for a sport and a passion for an animal. So you have the breeder who bred the animal, who is doing all the big winning. And then you have the people who love being in the sport of dog showing and support that dog financially and expect things at the end of the day. And then you have the handler who creates the space for the dog to be shown. And so then you have the dog having puppies later on. So you have so many venues for conflict. So the breeder, you know, this is my dog. Even though you're footing the bill for this dog, still it's my dog. No, I co-own it. Remember, you signed the papers. I co-own it. I can have a say. And they write these elaborate contracts with these elaborate contract attorneys who have no idea what the dog show world is about or the emotional upheaval of what can go on. And
well, let me ask about that, though, because I didn't realize that this happened. I figured you go to a breeder, you buy the dog. If you decide that you're going to show the dog, you own the dog. Maybe you have a handler who shows the dog, and that's it. But I didn't realize that there would be an ongoing relationship and perhaps a co-ownership between the breeder and the person who purchased the dog.
Well, in the world of courtrooms, if you don't continue a co-ownership with the dog and you have an issue, you can't go to litigation because you no longer own the dog. Unless your name is on the papers of the dog with the AKC, the court doesn't recognize you as an owner if you're a breeder. So a lot of us,
me included. But why would the breeder... Well, let me ask this. Then why would the breeder want to have a continued ownership or, you know, that What's the issue?
Well, good breeders want to have a continued relationship, whether they co-own or not, with the new owner because things happen. And good breeders, the ones who show at the dog shows, not the puppy millers, want to be able to take that dog back if it doesn't work out. If it, you know, you can't have it anymore because you've lost your job, you've gotten divorced, you can't find accommodation for you with the dog, your child who you didn't have when you bought the dog is allergic when it was born. Several reasons why, in fact, you can't keep this dog. Well, I want first dibs on getting the dog back because most of the reputable breeders feel they bring these dogs into the world, and these dogs are their responsibility till they hopefully close their eyes of natural causes. And they want to stay involved with the owner. You know, these aren't the people who are having puppies so their kids have the beauty of seeing a puppy being born. These are the people who spend their lives doing all the pre-breeding tests, doing all the history and what will make a better part of a dog, what will make the temperament better, what will make the structure better, what will make so that the dog lives longer and healthier. less allergies, less this, less that, take everything in consideration before they breed, then at the end of the day, they take their dogs back. I mean, there is a huge cadre of Irish Setter breeders. There'll be 300 in Fairfax, Virginia, well, 600 probably in Fairfax, Virginia in April of next year. And we all live to make the Irish Setter a better breed. And that's why the Irish Setter has better temperaments now than they did in the 70s. They are a phenomenal pet. But that's because the breeders are so conscientious. We have one of the largest foundations for health of any breed in the country because we want to make sure our dogs are healthy. The Golden Retriever has a huge foundation for health. So a reputable breeder who you buy from, who you can't get a dog when you want it, but you have to get on a waiting list and wait, those people will not sell the dog usually outright, especially not girls. They might sell boys outright. They won't sell girls outright because then people can go home and have these litters because they want their kids to see the beauty of birth, and they'll breed it with a Golden Retriever down the street who might be dysplastic, never do any of the health tests that come. And so you want to keep a finger on your puppies so that the dogs don't end up in shelters. So here you are, you have a litter of puppies, and you want to make sure that those puppies aren't bred unless the people take responsibility for the puppies they bring into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not going to happen,
I did not realize this.
They shouldn't have puppies. When I breed a litter of puppies, all those puppies are co-owned. I have birthday parties at my house every year for the hordes that come back. Some of them live in California,
wow.
So they don't necessarily come back. But the ones who live all the way in Maryland and Pennsylvania and Maine and Vermont, they all come back. They all come back to the house. And it's funny,
wow.
The owners say when they come up my hill, the dog starts to spin in the back. Now, the dog hasn't seen me in a year, and the dog starts to spin in the back because he knows he's home.
Oh, wow.
Because good breeders create the space where those dogs know them for life. And so if, God forbid, something happens to you, God forbid, you know, you have Alzheimer's, God forbid you have a stroke, God forbid you have something go wrong that you can no longer take care of this pet, with a reputable breeder, you know you can pick up the phone and say, listen, Deborah, I cannot keep, you know, Fluffy anymore. I need to return her. And I, because I'm crazy, I return half your purchase price for the life of the dog. So for the first 18 months, you get all your money back if you return the dog. After that, if you want to return me the dog at 10 years of age, which I've had one returned because the woman found a boyfriend who didn't like the dog, and so she returned it to me
after
at age 10.
Years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the dog came back, and he lived with me. He was phenomenal. And then a woman who had just lost her Irish Setter came to me and asked if I had anything. I said, I really don't. I just have this 10-year-old. And he lived another 5 years with another woman who had a dog from me. So
wow.
I take them back. I refund your money. Because for me, it is key that every dog I bring into this world is here because I brought it in. Not because anybody else did. So for me, that's my responsibility. And most of my colleagues feel the same way.
Right. Well, now that I understand this and everybody who's listening understands this, let's go back into the dog show world. And you know, you're talking about the kinds of issues that will come up between a breeder and owner and a handler. What goes on in there?
Okay, so when you're showing a dog, you're campaigning a dog is going from state to state to state, showing, and then you have the cost of the handler, the cost of the advertising, the future litters of the dog or the future litters of the female, who I'll call a bitch, and I apologize if I offended anybody, but that's how we refer to them.
Exactly, it's the word.
It's a word. It's not a criticism, it's a word. So if it's a female dog, then her show career is not as long as a male dog because, of course, dogs can be used at stud and still show. Girls can't really have puppies and come right back, bounce right back, although our Irish Setter this year at Westminster had puppies 18 months earlier and came back and won the breed and won the group and did beautifully.
Nice.
But she had no coat, as you saw. I don't know if you saw it, but she had no coat because we cut coats so the puppies don't strangle on the long, red, beautiful, flowing coat. So you have disagreements about what was the understanding. You have disagreements about who gets the first pick puppy. You have misunderstandings about placing the dog. You have misunderstandings about who gets what dog, when, who it ends up with, how it ends up that way. You have conflicts where people don't pay people. So if the handler doesn't get paid, there's a conflict. and who's supposed to pay the handler? There's a conflict. And I only do the advertising, but I'm not doing the advertising because you didn't let me, blah, blah, last time. So many conflicts that you couldn't even imagine. The movie Best in Show was a perfect depiction of the dog show world. There, you know, everybody has a personality, and it's those personalities that make it the wonderful sport it is, but it also makes it a little, you know, odd, and so you have to live within the oddities of people's personalities.
Wow, yes, I remembered the movie, and when I knew we were going to do this show, this is something that came to mind. I wasn't going to bring it up. But
when we saw that movie, we said, oh, my God, we were the people standing off to the side, not the bigger-than-life personalities, but each one of those bigger-than-life personalities are every day at every dog show.
Well, that's why I think also that your work is just so very fascinating, because you get to interact with and practice your mediation skills with people who are so very interesting. It's one of the reasons why I'm so hooked on mediation myself, is that I find people themselves to be so fascinating, and the very, you know, the nuances and varieties and personalities that one will come across, and how those come out in the midst of a conflict. So I can imagine, you know, being in a world that can attract, you know, people who are very interesting.
Absolutely. And you know, Beth Beale, educating people on the value of trying mediation first, because what I come up against often is that if I am contacted by someone to mediate a conflict, the first thing out of their mouth is, but they're going to think that I don't have a good case because I want to mediate.
Huh.
And I always say to them, well, you can always litigate. You can't necessarily go back after the barn is open and truly mediate unless your attorney is, you know, well-versed and well-educated in mediation and sees the value.
Right, right. That's such an important point. Yes, absolutely. I wanted to ask you then, you know, since you are in mediation, you were trained as an attorney first, you were an ADA, when did you discover mediation and decide to make that shift, and how did you do it?
Well, Ruth Raceman came and spoke to my class at the New Directions Program, which is part of Pace University Law School's reentry into the legal field. So if you haven't practiced law, they have a program called New Directions at Pace University Law School, where people who have a law degree, passed the bar, worked a long time ago as an attorney or never worked as an attorney and want to re-up in a, you know, fast-forward kind of way, you can do 6 months there. They do all the upticks for all the law that you've missed over the past however many years, and then they put you in an externship where you actually get a writing sample. You actually get a letter of recommendation because of the work you've done. So I did that in the summer of 2009, and I worked for a group called the Harlem Stage, who I love, and I did all of their
Stage.
The Harlem Stage is in the Water Tower at the top of the Bronx by CCNY. It's phenomenal. They are a group that create programs for the African American entertainment group that come across everywhere. It's phenomenal. I loved it.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have stayed there. They didn't need me full time, so that was, you know, so I went off on my own. But Ruth Raceman came in during that program and talked about mediation, and it just sort of clicked in the back of my brain. I just stuck it away. And then I went to the New York State Bar Association annual meeting in 2010, and on Wednesday there was the animal law committee meeting where everybody was fighting with each other and saying they were going to fight to the death because animals are so important, and believe me, I understand. And the courts hate them, but they're still going to be there because the courts are going to have to change the way animals are described and depicted, and they're valuable, and they're not just a chair, and they're not just property, and that's not how we feel about them anymore. And they're right. The American people, and actually people across the world, do not feel animals are property as much anymore as they did, say, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They're much more a part of our life now and not a chair. And it can't be a chair. It's just not going to go back. So I'm sitting in there, and they're all sort of arguing. And then the next day was the Dispute Resolution Committee meeting where they said, we are the people who the courts send all those cases they never want to hear. And so the light bulb went on. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. I am going to create a space where people who are in conflict over animals will have a place to discuss what it is they're in conflict with, because the courts can't allow them to get emotional and to say what they feel. It's
right.
not, there's no ability to do that.
I'm glad you're saying this. I am so very glad you're saying this, because it is a message that I strive to get across as well, that the benefit, you know, you talk about the benefits of mediation. When it comes to marketing something, you don't want to be talking about features so much, but you want people to understand what are they going to be able to get out of it. And, you know, people go into litigation with an idea of what they see perhaps on television, that they're going to be able to get in there and fight and you know, fulfill that need for vindication. And then what ends up happening is what you described earlier, where you lose your First Amendment rights because somebody else is speaking for you, and it can be very silencing and disempowering. So understanding that that kind of empowerment can and does happen in mediation, I'm really glad to hear you saying that as well, and I'm hoping that folks are listening and can understand this and give it a try.
Absolutely, and quite frankly, even when my clients won, they didn't win
yes.
because of the loss of relationships.
Right, right, right. Wow. So what kind of training did you do then once you decided that you were going to get into mediation?
I started my mediation at the phenomenal Mark Kleinman and Michelle Leonard group down at Community Mediation Services in Jamaica. So I did a year's worth of internship there after my initial 40-hour training. I also did the family training and the parent-child training. I did every training I think they offered, because I just was like a sponge for mediation, because my first mediation class, I was so bad because I'm a litigator. I knew the answer. I needed
sure.
to tell them the answer. That is exactly
sure.
what I needed to do. So for we litigators, it is almost impossible to sit down and wait and live out that silence or enable conflict to be in the room, because it's very hard for us to have people speak honestly and not nicely sometimes to other people, but it needs to get out so they feel heard. So we're trained not to allow that to happen, but you really have to.
Right.
And then I went to Westchester to Jenny Bench and Kathleen Keener at Cluster. So I did an internship there as well. So I'm certified in Jamaica. I'm certified in Westchester County. And then the last but not least, and I think I did them in the correct order, I did Jack Himmelstein's program with Catherine Miller and Sequoia Stadler. And that really was, and Adam Berner, and that really was the top of the mark for me, because that created that piece I was missing. And I continue now to take a mastermind group with Jack Himmelstein and a number of family mediators, divorce mediators, and court mediators every once a month, so that we keep our finger in the pot. And they love when I present because it's so different. They bring such insight to me and my biases that make me a better mediator. I think that if mediators could create mastermind groups like Jack has, where they sit down and have these conversations so that they can become better mediators because they're listening to other mediators on how they would do it, it would create a buzz for our profession that would be huge, because you wouldn't get stuck in your own mindset, which a mediator sometimes has a hard time because you live in a vacuum. It really enables you to have varied mindsets, and so you can bring to the table the best that you are.
Right, absolutely. And speaking of what you're doing currently, you also have mentioned that the information that you sent to me, that you're creating an Institute for Alternative Animal Conflict Resolution. Tell me about that.
Oh, that's my baby. That'll be out in November. So Hamilton Law Mediation has been the platform from which I have done my animal conflict mediation, and I was approached by Colorado State University Vet School to speak to their veterinarians about animal conflict resolution in their practices, so to have that conflict conversation before litigation ensues. And so when I presented them with my program, I said, well, Hamilton Law Mediation really doesn't say what this is, So my web designer and I decided we would create the Institute for Animal Alternative Conflict Resolution, so that we will create this piece where people can come and learn how to help people in conflict over animals resolve those conflicts without litigation. So that the litigation that needs to be done can be done, but the people who need to have resolution but without litigation can learn how to do it there.
Would a person need to have any special training or background with animals to do animal mediation, do you think?
I think that it would make it easier if you owned an animal, because you would be able to have the empathy that we as mediators realize is so important when we speak to people. We all sort of migrate towards something we feel competent in, because we then can respect the people who don't want animals and respect the people who do, because you understand both sides of the coin, for me. And for labor attorneys or labor mediators, you understand the worker's mentality and the employer's mentality. You migrate toward what feels right. So people who have an affinity for animals and who are mediators would probably make wonderful animal conflict mediators. Veterinarians could do it as well if they are able to remain neutral. That's the key, as you know, Beth Beal, remaining neutral, having your own biases and recognizing them and leaving them at the door. So, yeah, I think that a good mediator who is a pet owner can provide that neutral space, as long as they leave their biases at the door. I have to, so everyone has to.
Right. So if somebody is interested in either getting your services as a pet mediator or becoming a mediator who focuses on animals, how might they reach you?
They can reach me at www.hamiltonlawmediation.com right now, or my office number is 914-273-1085. You can also email me at dhamilton@hamiltonlawandmediation, all one word, .com. And I'd be happy to put you in touch with various mediation classes that I've taken, or put you in touch with the people that I speak to who want mediation as an alternative resolution for their conflict. I'm out there speaking everywhere. I speak to dog park groups. I speak to real estate groups because of the conflicts in condos, co-ops, landlord-tenant, you name it. I speak everywhere. And quite frankly, if this resonates with some of your listeners, what they need to do is create a space to speak to people who may be in conflict. So if they're a member of a dog park, go out there and talk about mediation. If they're a member of a dog training group, go out there and talk about mediation. You know, don't think that because it's never been done before, it can't be done. I don't know how many people told me when I said I was only handling conflicts between people over animals, and they said, you'll never make a living at that. I said, watch me. Because people who are in conflict over animals don't have the same access to the court system as people who are in conflict over a chair or over children, because the courts will address that. People in conflict
right.
over an animal, really, they don't. And so to have the ability to have the conversation is so much more valuable, and making people aware of what they stand to win and what they stand to lose in a given conflict makes it more tangible for them to say, maybe I'll settle, maybe I'll do this. Because most people don't want to come to mediation because, well, unless you sue me, I don't have to talk to you. But if I sue you, look at all the ramifications. You might, if you have a dog bite, say, you might lose the insurance to your home because your dog bit somebody. So maybe you would like to have a mediated settlement instead of waiting for litigation, which then could have a whole cadre of things come down on your head that you never even realized.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, too. We're coming down to the last minute or so of the show, but I had wanted to ask you about those kinds of situations where, it's all serious from the standpoint of needing closure, certainty, and emotion, but in situations where it is something like a dog bite, where somebody could sue, have the dog put down, where the consequences could be really dire, for the owner, and then the harm, to the person who was bitten is serious as well. You're saying that those situations can be mediated too?
Absolutely, because what happens is the people have to recognize that they have a better chance of not having their dogs euthanized if they create a space to work out a resolution with the person who's injured, so that this will never happen again. What you may need to do is give up your dog. There was an article in a dog magazine where a child who had a service dog who bit a child who was visiting and did serious damage, the dog was slated to be put to sleep. And they sat down, the people sat down and had a conversation, realized that this service dog was so valuable to this little girl. And so they said, well, she can't live with the dog any longer, but the dog can go live with somebody else. And so the dog left and is living on a farm and is still alive, and she can go visit it, but it's no longer a threat to other children. So there are things you can work out in a mediation that can't possibly be given time or substance in court because it's outside the parameters of what the court can look at.
Right, right. Such important information that you've shared with us, and the stories are interesting as well. I can imagine folks having continued interest in this, so I'm hoping that you'll be getting hits on your website and calls from folks who are interested in this very fascinating area that I hope grows, because as a person who loves animals myself, and I've had dogs as well and want to have dogs in the future, I'm quite curious about this area and want to be sure that I can take advantage of the resources. And I'm glad that you decided to get out there and not listen to the naysayers, but say watch me, and I think they're still watching you now.
Well, I sure hope so, and it is huge, and I know that it's going to become something. Someone said to me once, why are you helping other people do what it is that you do? I said, because I can't do it alone. And I know there are other people out there who feel the same way and can do this. And between all of us, we'll create the space where legitimately people will know that this process is there for them to help them solve their conflicts and retain their relationships with the people they're in conflict with.
Beautiful. Well, what a lovely way to end. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Deborah. I really appreciate your coming in and appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you so much for the platform. I greatly appreciate it. And anyone who wants to call me, I left my information, and please do. I'd be happy to chat with them.
Go ahead and say it one more time.
Okay, you can reach me in my office at 914-273-1085. My email is dhamilton@hamiltonlawandmediation.com. And you can look at my website and all the articles I've written at www.hamiltonlawandmediation.com.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, and thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back again with another episode next week. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Bye-bye.